This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
It's time for our Monday serial, a respectable veneer written by Rachel Doré, published by Upstart Press and narrated by Romy Hooper. This serial has been made possible by funding from the Earl Creativity and Development Trust with collaboration from Manawatu People's Radio. A Respectable Veneer is a story about love and courage, but we remind you of our regular content warning. There are elements of violence and references to child abuse. Last episode, Ruby had a disastrous evening at Janice's place.
The house lights in the auditorium dimmed, and they got to their feet for God Save the Queen as the curtains over the screen opened. Douglas smiled at Edie as they sang. Ruby mouthed the words and watched for people who did the same. The black and white face of the glamorous young monarch in her coronet and bejeweled gown smiled, huge on the glittering screen. Ruby felt Douglas's sleeve rub against hers. Somewhere to their left, a burble of comments and hissing broke out, accompanied by shushing from others in the audience.
"Stand up, why don't you? Shame. Shame. On your feet. Shame. Bloody commie. Boo. Throw him out."
Beams of torchlight crisscrossed in the dark as the ushers scoped the audience for the troublemaker.
"What's going on?" Edie whispered.
"Somebody's not standing for the Queen," Ruby told her. There was a brief scuffle as a group of men roughly escorted someone, or more than one person, it was hard to tell, out of the cinema. When the men returned without the miscreants, a few people in that part of the audience applauded. Ruby was between Douglas and Edie, who sat on the aisle side of the row. In the darkness, Ruby rested her wrist on the armrest so he might see it. His hands remained tucked under his crossed arms during the newsreel. An aerial view showed thousands of people in England flocking to see the Britannia, bringing the Queen and Prince Philip home from their Commonwealth tour.
"We missed her," said Edie. "Auntie Pym said she saw her here in Palmerston North. Fancy, the Queen, here."
"Shush. Shh."
The screen whited with the mushroom cloud explosion of a hydrogen bomb test. Looking along the row, Ruby saw faces blanched in the whiteness. Douglas flinched. A crisp voice accompanied the film as some dark-skinned former inhabitants of an annihilated Pacific island met with white men in uniforms to parley about their prospects.
"Poor beggars."
The next segment showed the New Zealand troops preparing for involvement in the Malayan emergency, and Ruby saw Douglas shake his head. The film was making it seem like the latest crop of young soldiers were lads likely to have fun with their bayonets. She put her hand on Douglas's arm. The serge of his jacket sleeve was under her fingers, but the flesh of him seemed to have disappeared inside it. After the intermission, when the last stragglers had bumped past knees on their way back to their seats, the feature film started. Doris Day, in buckskin trousers as Calamity Jane, sang her head off. Settled in his seat, Douglas had not once nudged towards her or slid his arm along the back of the seat in a tentative manoeuvre to touch her shoulders. Would he, with Edie sitting there? When his shoulder rubbed against hers, it was only to reach inside his jacket pocket for a box of snifters.
"You're in charge of these," he whispered,
tearing the lid off the narrow cardboard box and taking the first one for himself. There was that boyishness again, grinning with the oval bulge of lolly in his cheek, drumming his fingers on his knee to every rollicking chorus. Edie slotted lollies into her mouth with the mechanical movement of an automaton when they were offered.
Ruby sucked on the spearmint-coated chocolate sweet, hating the film. The music was just the sort of catchy nonsense that drilled into people's heads. Edie was likely to repeat at least one of the songs for weeks. Douglas's eyes shone with a smile when he caught Ruby looking at him. Or was it she, catching him looking at her? By the time Wild Bill Hickok started singing how he'd lost his heart, Ruby released a long, audible sigh.
"You all right?" Douglas whispered.
She nodded, her eyes on Doris Day flinging herself about, and offered him another snifter. The cinema crowd poured onto the pavement, mingling with the others arriving for the next session. Ruby kept a grip of Edie's hand. Douglas gave her his elbow. There they were, he staring them through the crowd, then the two of them arm in arm through the light drizzle to the Morris with Edie skipping along, predictably singing. They might be mistaken for a family. Thankfully, the car was nearby. "Take Me Back to the Hills" was getting on her nerves. "That's quite enough," she said as Edie got into the back seat. Droplets of rain shattered the streetlight on the window as they pulled away. She should be happy. Girls dream of this. A handsome, likable, if not lovable, man who might like her. A child humming a tune in the back seat. On the side window, rivulets now striped the glass, distorting buildings, shop windows, and the few figures she could make out on a dark street corner as they passed. Did she see the muskrat coat, bedraggled in the rain? People stood outside other picture theatres. Somewhere behind these frontages there'd be music, a dance hall. Ruby glanced at Douglas and quickly turned her face away. He leaned forward, focused on the rain-splattered road ahead, a slight smile on his lips. She came perilously close to imagining herself in love with him. He was a gentle, considerate man, a gentleman in the truest sense. If she were honest, the only cause for her unsettled feelings about him was that it was hard to understand why he showed no sign of wanting her. Deep underneath that, a more disturbing notion began to occur. She'd become so accustomed to men wanting her, she'd never stopped to ask herself what she felt about them. The question itself repulsed her. Douglas didn't want her. He was being a friend. It was she, being a fool, expecting him to notice her. After all, isn't that how the game goes? The man is drawn to the woman when she's attractive? Ruby was attractive, she knew that. It was what she'd learned to do. It was all quite mad. Mad. She stopped wondering about him. Instead, she flicked through the pages of her past, unable to recall a single man she'd liked. Certainly not her father. As far back as she remembered, all her interactions with men had been, one way or another, in the nature of a trade, a transaction. They wanted her, bought her, and she had to pretend she liked it. Repeats of a tawdry old play that was acted out over and over again. Douglas didn't use the same script. Maybe he didn't know the script at all. It dawned on her then. She didn't want him either. She'd never liked men, and she didn't want one to touch her, not ever again. The whole idea sickened her.
"Penny for him," Douglas said.
She'd hardly noticed he'd slowed to a stop. In the back seat, Edie was humming, looking out the window. "Just thinking how pleasant this is," Ruby said. "I've had a lovely time."
"My pleasure," he said.
She smiled.
"Shall we have cocoa?"
He grinned warmly.
"Yes, please," said Edie.
By the time Ruby had dug Edie's book out from underneath her roughly folded clothes, Edie had fallen asleep. Ruby tucked her in and crept out, locking the door behind her. The ink spots warbled out of the kitchen radio. Pim was singing in a cracked voice as she wiped down one of the stoves.
And what makes my head go round and round, while my heart stands still?
Douglas sat at the table, wearing a pained grin. As Ruby entered, he pulled out the chair next to him. How old-fashioned he was! I felt like some company, she said. But I shan't stay long.
Lovebirds, hee-hee,
Pym chuckled.
Never thought I'd see it, Mr. Woods. Don't worry, I'll be out of your hair in a tick.
He toyed with the pom-pom on the tea cosy. Want a hand, Pym? Ruby asked.
It's all right, love. Nearly done. Would all this be true if I didn't care for you?
Oh. Pim's voice wavered and broke in her attempt to reach a note, which brought on a fit of coughing. Oh, God! Ruby hadn't said it aloud, had she? Douglas put his hand over his mouth. The corners of his laughing eyes watered, giving him away. Pym switched off the radio.
Right then. Leave you two to it. Good night. You be nice now, Mr. Woods.
As the door closed behind her, Douglas wiped his eyes with his handkerchief, breathless with released laughter.
Did you get Calamity Jane to sleep all right?
He said, when he'd recovered. Dead to the world, she said.
Thank you for this evening, he said.
If I never hear the Black Hills again, it'll be too soon.
At least Edie can hold a tune. I think she has a promising voice.
Ruby knew it. Still, it was good hearing it from him. He had a fine voice and he knew about music, so his compliment carried some weight.
It's been a while since I had so much fun, he said. I'm in your debt.
She looked under the muslin cover on the milk jug. There was enough. Edie really enjoyed herself. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Douglas pulled half a loaf out of the bread bin.
I feel like a mousetrap, he said, lighting the gas under the grill. You?
Will it leave enough bread for breakfast?
There's an untouched loaf there. You slice the cheese. I'll try not to burn the toast.
Was this what the first stages of domestic bliss were like? The sooner she moved out, away from him, the better. It wouldn't do her any good to think that moments of happiness could be as easily had as this.
Did I mention how terrific you look with your hair short like that?
He glanced at her. Only three times. She nibbled a ragged corner of mild cheddar. Slicing cheese evenly had never been her forte.
It's like you're giving the world a look at the real you. The dazzling Ruby.
Stop it.
Honestly, when we were driving back, you were gazing out the window. I saw a glimpse of the curve of your neck.
Was he making fun of her? It was tempting to biff a bit of cheese at him. Stop it. My mother always said gushing was common, she sniffed, feigning snobbishness.
Surely it's only common when it's insincere, he parried. I can't help possessing a certain aesthetic appreciation.
Well, I don't like it. I might let it grow back just to spite you.
You shouldn't.
The toast's ready to turn, she said.
I shan't be surprised if an artist sees you and locks you in his studio until he's done half a dozen paintings of you.
That was not as funny as he supposed. It would spoil the evening to let her irritation show. I'll take my tea upstairs if you carry on. Ruby rested her chin in her hand and watched him cut the crusts off the toast. He scraped on a layer of Marmite and arranged cheese on the top. Such precision. She smiled behind her hand.
He frowned as he held up half a slice of cheese that she'd cut badly. It was thick at one end and almost paper-thin at the other. He seemed unsure whether he could bring himself to use it.
"Pepper?"
He waved the pepper shaker. She nodded.
"How's number 5?
He said. "Colder than number 9, and damper," she said. "I'm browned off about Mrs. Thompson wanting 30 shillings for it." His back was turned. He was carefully positioning the grill tray under the flame, saying nothing. "Douglas," she began, "Edie and I can't go on staying here." The cheese was bubbling as he lifted the tray out.
"Where are you going to go?"
"There's somewhere Edie and I could dig in for a couple of weeks, if I like."
"Pillar to post, so to speak," he said.
"Then what?" Did he have to sum it up like that? It cut her. He picked up the knife.
"Shall we have these in fingers or quarters?"
She no longer wanted to eat. "Fingers," she said.
"Ruby,"
he said gently as he put the plate of mousetraps, cut into quarter triangles, on the table.
"Pour the tea and eat.
I've got an idea that may interest you.
You're not doing anything tomorrow, are you?"
"You're not doing anything tomorrow. Who the hell does he think he is, saying that?" She leaned her chin into her hand, wishing she could say she was busy. And if his idea was going to wedge her into yet another obligation, she'd turn it down flat. Still, the idea of the empty day ahead didn't appeal. It wouldn't hurt to listen. He'd devoured 3 triangles of mousetrap before she answered. "What sort of idea?" she said, taking a bite of savoury greasiness. It was good with pepper. Salt would make it better, but she wasn't going to say so.
"Tomorrow, I'd like to take you both for a Sunday drive," he said. "Show you a bit of the countryside."
He topped up her tea.
"Then we'll go round to my chum Frank's place for a bit of lunch."
It was almost midnight when they said goodnight. The wires under the mattresses creaked as she slipped into her bed. She pounded the fusty, lumpy pillow into shape. According to Douglas, this friend of his, Frank, needed a housekeeper. She had refrained from telling him that the idea held appeal. Instead, she'd badgered him for details. Frank's health had worsened over the years.
"He hasn't done well," Douglas had said. "He needs someone there."
If she and Edie moved into Frank's house, she'd be able to keep an eye on him, call the doctor when he had one of his bad turns. Other than that, the job was ordinary housekeeping. Douglas wanted him to have someone on hand to cook proper meals and so on. He presented a list of good reasons why he believed it could benefit everyone. It would ease his mind, he'd said. Ruby had promised to think it over after she'd talked to this Frank chap herself. She wasn't going to give up her job now that she'd got one, and it depended on Edie too. What if Frank was in a really awful way? What if it was dodgy? She didn't sense anything duplicitous about Douglas. Still, what if? The bed protested loudly as she tossed over. How dare Douglas assume he knew what was best for her? How dare he regard her as someone who was in a jam? Was it that obvious? Did everybody see it? Madam saw it, didn't she?
"Your circumstances are of no interest," she'd said.
Circumstances. Her circumstances exhausted her. She hadn't run a household before, let alone looked after a man in ill health. How ill was he? Bloody Douglas! What right had he? He was treating her as though he was her older brother. It was no comfort. He was playing brother to this Frank chap as well, and she hated him for thinking he was so goddamn right. She ground her teeth. Grilled cheese and recrimination were a bad combination at that hour. And she was cold.
It was ridiculously miserly of her not to have brought a couple of hot water bottles when she knew the nights were cold. After all, she'd spent money she shouldn't have on a little black cardigan and a sale-priced tiered petticoat to make her pale blue skirt look better when they went out. She couldn't very well wear her Vardo clothes everywhere. Until she finished paying for them, they weren't hers. Eventually, needing warmth, she tore the blanket off her bed, put it over Edie, and got into bed next to her.
You've been listening to A Respectable Veneer, a serialized novel by Rachel Doré, read by Romy Hooper. Listen to the next episode at 8 p.m. next Monday, or for the rest of the series, go to npr.nz/show/respectableveneer, or search for A Respectable Veneer wherever you find your podcasts.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.